Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport on the day of both the Cincinnati Western and Southern Open finals, which have seen champions crowned in the form of Garbiñe Muguruza and Grigor Dimitrov. We've seen Simona Halep flop at her chance to become world number one. We've seen Nick Kyrgios, well, lose today, but surprise us all by reaching the final. I think that's something that David Law is going to address momentarily. This is episode 339 of the Tennis Podcast, and it is our final Tennis Podcast before each of us jet off to New York. So we'd better make it a good one, David Law.
We had, hadn't we? Yeah, it's can't believe we're off to New York. It'll be my 15th go, and I'm still kind of a bit wide-eyed about it all.
Your 15th go on the wheel of New York.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I can't wait.
I still get wide-eyed about New York as well. I love all the slam. People get down on the US. Journalists get a bit down on the US Open more than the others. I think because of where it is in the calendar, everyone's just a bit exhausted, perhaps because of the buses that you have to get from. You just generally stay in Manhattan and it can be sort of an hour long bus in the morning. But it's the one that gives me the tingly feeling because it's New York.
Yeah.
And there's nowhere like New York.
I never fail to get off the plane and go through the immigration and be a little bit scared about the whole process, as if I've done something wrong and I might be about to get thrown in some sort of jail. And also just, yeah, the wide-eyed excitement of it all.
Yeah, I get the wide-eyed excitement in that situation too. However, immigration queues in the United States bring out the absolute worst in Catherine Whittaker.
Such as?
I know you think you've seen the worst in Catherine Whittaker on the podcast and in real life many a time, but you haven't, because I don't think we've ever stood in an immigration queue together. I think the one thing that annoys me more than anything else in the world, and trust me, I don't say that lightly, because you know I was on a Southwest trains earlier and people were not respecting the quiet carriage rules, and that was pretty annoying. But I think if I had to pick one thing more than any other, it's people that enjoy their minute amount of power 1,000 times more than they should. That is my biggest bugbear. And you can apply that to the people that to whom I think that applies most is US airport immigration employees and train ticket collectors, or fair enforcement officers, as they refer to themselves. Sometimes I just see a bit red and lose it a bit and then realise I'm sort of at risk of prosecution or worse, and end up having to reluctantly back down.
I now really want to arrange to be at the airport when this is going on.
I don't think you do. I don't think you do. Once the entire contents of my suitcase got searched in, so I was connecting somewhere and I'd bought a salad from Pret-a-Manger at Heathrow Airport and I hadn't eaten it on the plane. I thought, oh, I'll keep it and bring it through with me. Anyway, they asked me to identify every single vegetable in the salad. They actually pointed at a pea and said, "What's that, ma'am?" And I said, "I think it's a pea." And then I did a joke. I was like, "I don't know, could be a petit pois." You know, I wouldn't like to stick my neck on the line. They don't enjoy jokes, David.
No,
they don't enjoy jokes at all.
I've fallen foul of that
a
few times. Yeah, you can imagine me. I really struggle with that bit. But
yeah. Anyway, we are looking forward to New York.
We are,
in spite of this.
Yes,
I think what's happened in Cincinnati this week, as much as particularly on the men's side, at the start of the week, it started on a bit of a damp note because of the pullouts beforehand, because of the almost inevitable pullout of Roger Federer, and there were, you know, there were a few. I mean, that genuinely there were two names. I can only remember one of them now, in the first round draw that I'd never heard of on the men's side. And that's, I mean, I'd like to think that's really saying something. There were some, that I think there wasn't anybody in qualifying. Oh no, there were only two qualifiers that didn't end up getting into the draw as lucky losers. That's how many people pulled out. But in fact, I think it shaped up really well. Particularly the latter stages. I think the women's tournament was fantastic throughout. It's set up the US Open perfectly, I think, albeit slightly bizarrely, but perfectly.
Yeah, it has. It has. I find the whole journey of Garbiñe Muguruza this year interesting, because I'm sort of been waiting for her to take over, really, for such a long time. And she had such a terrible spring, you know, the injuries that she was having, and I think she pulled out of either Dubai or Doha with an Achilles problem at one stage. And, you know, she sometimes throws in these awful performances, that one in Eastbourne where she lost one on love to Barbora Strizova. But then she's won Wimbledon, and the big thing for me is that she's backed it up. You know, this is the first time she's won big or got to a big final, a Grand Slam final, and then backed it up. I mean, the fact that she played Stanford straight away, didn't win it, but she got to the semis. Then she played Toronto and lost out to Svitolina. And then she backs it up again. I mean, she was match points down against Madison Keys, I think, in the quarterfinals. And isn't it interesting how many players get match point down and end up winning tournaments? You know, we think of Stan Wawrinka last year.
Well, in 2017 it is. I know Wawrinka at the US. Is it just me, or does it feel like it's happening more? That could be total confirmation bias. I'm fully aware of that.
It's happened a lot recently.
It really feels like it's happening more.
Yeah, I mean, well, we were here a week ago, weren't we, talking about Zverev saving that match point against Gasquet with the 49 stroke.
Of course, Kerber did it Australian Open last year. She was match points down in the first round, so...
Yeah.
Against Misaki Doi, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Very good memory. And ended up winning that match. So Muguruza against Keys, and then she got through the semis in a tough three-setter that was nearly 3 hours long as well. I can't even remember who that was against now. I commentated on it like yesterday, and I can't even remember it. But anyway, she got through that one. And then she ended up, you mentioned in the intro about Halep. I just didn't know what to make of that. I mean, that's twice in as many weeks that she's lost really heavily.
Well, I'm going to need you to tell me what to make of it, David, because I have a major confession to make here, and that's that I was visiting my mum this weekend, last time I see her before I go to New York, and obviously wanted to see Rosie as well to get her urgent predictions for New York. And I was in a race against time to get home from my mum and dad's in time for the women's final. And this is where Southwest trains come into the equation and the lack of respect for the quiet carriage. I'm looking at the clock. I'm looking at the fact that the train stopped at a red signal outside Richmond, and that's really unhelpful. And I'm thinking, okay, I might miss the first set, but, you know, I'll get there for the nitty gritty. Well, not only was there not any nitty gritty, but the tennis. By the time I got home, David, tennis had stopped happening. I missed all of that 6-1, 6-love demolition. I couldn't believe my eyes. I predicted Muguruza to win. I did not predict that. I did have my fears for Halep. She hasn't responded well to pressure and to self-expectation. I think it's self-expectation as much as anything. She hasn't brilliantly of late, you know, French Open final, evidence of that. And the fact that she was playing for world number one today, I don't think helped her. But yeah, frankly, for the details, David, over to you.
Well, the one thing I would say in, I don't want to say in her defence, but in some form of mitigation, that she's one of the players who played, I think, twice in a day. And we saw that last week. Certain players kind of ran into the wall, really, when they were playing multiple matches. But I don't think she was physically impaired today. I saw her play against Johanna Konta. I thought she was fantastic against Konta.
She was, you know, yeah.
And Konta came out caning the ball. And I said early on in that match, if Konta keeps playing like this, I'm not sure Halep will live with it, because certain players are able to overpower Halep. But she kept going.
And I thought she might have mental issues against Konta, because she has lost to her a couple of times recently from a setup. I thought that might mentally play on her, but no, she was really mentally strong yesterday and then today. I mean, I know Muguruza can just knock you on the court, or knock you off the court. I know that. You know, if it had been 2-3 or 3-4 or 3-3, you know, I'd have gone, okay, Muguruza can do that to people, but one and love.
Yeah.
Crikey.
And I mean, towards the end of the first set, she, I think maybe it was at 4-1, she called Darren Cahill onto the court, and it was, I mean, look, he came on initially and he gave some tactical and technical advice. He said, I think you're playing okay. She's playing really well. There's not that much in it, even though it's 4-1. It's only a point here or there. But she wears this look of cynicism on her face when he's talking, of as if to say, yeah, well, it's going wrong. And you don't know what you're talking about, really. And
do you know who they remind me of?
Who's that?
You and me.
Oh, yeah. Explain.
And I'm just being relentlessly cynical and negative about something, and you just completely ignore me and just calmly and rationally fight my cynicism with your own positivity and just completely just ignore my arsiness.
Off the podcast.
I mean, that's the worst possible spin I can put on it from my perspective.
I mean, today
it does remind me a bit of that, just how completely unfazed he is.
Yeah.
I'm sure behind the scenes he lets himself get fazed by it, but in the moment he's unfazed, isn't he? He just doesn't take it. He just pretends she's not doing it, and he says, you're doing great. He just puts his positive spin on stuff.
Well,
and is such, I mean, I find him soothing and calming from my sofa.
It was quite.
He's got that, you know, he's got that airline pilot voice, hasn't he? Of just, he just calms you.
It was quite interesting listening to the one today, though, because initially he said the technical and tactical advice. Then he said something my old coach used to say to me about backing myself, and if I was positive about it, about myself and my chances, then good things would happen and I would find my feet working better. And as he was delivering that line, she started shaking her head and said, not looking at him but shaking her head and saying, yeah, it always has to come down to my attitude, doesn't it? What about what I need to actually do to win these points, you know? And then he quickly turned it on its head. He said, all right then, fine, we'll do it. You know, it was effective, like, right, we'll do it your way then. I would suggest you do this and this. But that's what he's up against, really. And look, I cut her some slack because the stress in the moment, I do appreciate that. It's easy. It's a bit, as much as I love on-court coaching, it's harsh on the players.
Is the relationship turning too much parent-child, though?
Well, it's quite interesting that during that Konta match, it was suggested by Nigel Sears in commentary that maybe Konta wasn't calling Wim Fisette on because she was trying to get used to not having him around ahead of the US Open.
Ahead of the US Open,
and,
that's interesting.
You know,
yeah.
I can believe that. And it was also instructive for me that at the end of the match, Muguruza went straight over to Sam Sumik and her physio and just gave them the biggest bear hug. You know, and so many times that feels an uncomfortable, frosty relationship in terms of on-court exchanges.
Especially that she, you know, he wasn't around when she won Wimbledon. You know, she had Conchita Martinez by her side, and he was over stateside tending to some family stuff. So it's nice that he's been involved in some success of hers subsequently.
Yeah. And I mean, and
she obviously gives him a lot of credit for it.
I do feel, I mean, look, it goes without saying that there are big question marks still about Simona Halep, because she has not proved that she can win the really big matches yet. And I don't want to be unkind, because she's a cracking player. I love watching her. She's the best athlete in the game. And I just still feel, though, that she is there to influence on the other side of the net. If you can get in her head, she can go. And players know that. And the total opposite is true of Muguruza. Her game can go off. She can sometimes not be quite with it. But she is a big match occasion player. And she's getting better. I mean, yeah. Look, I said at the, I'm going to keep saying it. I said at the start of the year she would be world number one at the end of it, and I still believe that.
I think it's looking more and more like you will be right. And having made that prediction when you did, if that is proven right, that will be quite some prediction, I think. But we'll wait the requisite months before giving you credit for that. I certainly think she's favourite for the US Open now, in my mind at least. I think, you know, Pliskova was in my mind as a rival for the favourite position, but Muguruza beat her pretty comprehensively in that semi-final yesterday. So that's put Muguruza ahead of the pack for me. Not by much. It's still, you know, quite the free-for-all, but she's the favourite. Simona Halep, interestingly, she will still most likely become world number one at the US Open, because the gap by Halep reaching the final this week is narrowed to the extent that she, I don't know exactly what it is, obviously it depends on what Pliskova does, but Pliskova is defending final points.
Yeah, it's a lot
from
points
last year. Halep is defending significantly fewer. What did Halep do, fourth round?
You know, I can't remember what Halep did at the US Open last year.
I think fourth round. Anyway, significantly fewer. So we have a situation where Simona Halep will most likely take over World Number One, except that the fact that she knows that could cause her to, I think, you know, she's susceptible to losing round one or, you know, early rounds US Open because of that. That's what today has made me think. I don't know. She's a mystery to me. She's a fascinating mystery that's made all the more fascinating by the insights we get from her exchanges with Darren Cahill. I find the dynamic and everything about it fascinating. Mm. My worry is, as much as I'm suggesting maybe that relationship isn't working, is going in the wrong direction, I can't imagine anybody better for her than him.
No.
I think he's the best possible influence. So if that doesn't work, I fear for her.
I think he's one of the best coaches in the world. I really do.
Oh, me too. Me too.
And to hear other coaches talk about him as well, that only reinforces that view. Incidentally, I mean, it's a real shame not to have Serena Williams to watch, at least from a selfish tennis observer's point of view. It's a shame that there are so many men injured and that there are big names that are not going to be there. And this is a tennis-y view, because not having those players will certainly reduce the global impact of the tournament. But just from a sort of selfish tennis-y point of view, I think this is a super exciting US Open in prospect because of those things
Absolutely.
You've just said. The fact that Simona Halep could come up against big hitters early on and you don't know what's going to happen. And we say Muguruza is kind of the favourite, but that's feels like such a flimsy element of being the favourite.
Yeah, it's almost not even worth picking favourites for this US Open, is it? It's open to that extent. And I agree, fabulously exciting. It might not pull in the ultimate casual tennis fan in the way that another tournament with all the big names might. Although on the men's side, ratings suggest that Federer and Nadal are the ones that pull in the casual tennis fans, and they're going to be there. So obviously Serena is a big loss, but that's one big major loss. I know from a nerdy tennis fan's point of view, Djokovic, Wawrinka, Nishikori, you know, these are all big losses for us. We want all the big guys there. I just happen to, you know, I get a bit of insight into viewing figures and the various impacts that different players have on them. And obviously in this country, Murray and Konta are the ones that have the biggest impact. But taking country allegiances away from it, it's Federer edges Nadal in this country. I'm sure it's different elsewhere, but those two pull in the really casual viewers like no other, and Serena. So we've got one of those missing, which is a big shame. But yeah, I think for us nerdy tennis fans, it's going to be a treat. The men's tournament, David.
And it's similar, isn't
He's done it. He's done it. Well, he's done something.
Well, yeah. I mean, Grigor Dimitrov,
he's done it when he wins Wimbledon.
26 but, years of age. He's 26.
26 and... years of age. I was so pleased for him. I really am. I'm pleased for Nick Kyrgios. We'll talk about Grigor first, shall we? Because I'm struggling to say what's different about Grigor this week, other than that it's all come together. He is a fantastic physical specimen. He works so hard off the court. His athleticism was the difference today. But I believe that athleticism has been there for a few years now. You know, he has been fantastically fit and sort of lithe and flexible and all sort of the perfect mix of Federer-type athleticism with a bit of the Djokovic flexibility and all of that in there, and kind of almost the movement of Nadal, albeit a bit different. But yeah, I'm struggling to put my finger on why it clicked this week. I don't know. I'm glad it did. I feel slightly more confident about his chances at the US Open than I would otherwise have. I still don't feel... You know, we've been burned enough times that I still don't feel, you know, I wouldn't be placing my house or non-existent mortgage on Grigor Dimitrov. But help me, David.
Yeah, a couple of things. I think the biggest thing for me is that I feel like he won this tournament in a relatively unspectacular way. And that's one of the biggest compliments I think I can give him. He is Mr.
Yeah, it hasn't been flashy tennis. No. I mean, there's been the odd flashy shot, but it's actually his variety that's been best this week. He's done a really good job of keeping the ball low, and he has the range of shots to be able to do that. You're right, it has been his more conservative shot selections that have really paid off for him.
Yeah. He, in that match against Kyrgios today, for instance, he went in with a very clear game plan. And he beat Kyrgios in the way that Murray beats Kyrgios, which is to just deny him pace, which is to use his athleticism and his hand skills, not for highlight reel moments, although there were one or two, but mainly just to stay in rallies and to just keep asking questions of Nick Kyrgios throughout the match. Come on, beat me. You won't because I'll keep getting the back.
Which must take a lot of restraint for Grigor Dimitrov, because he loves to be a shot maker. He loves to be the flashy showman. But he had to walk onto that court going, no, I'm playing a flashy showman. I don't want to get involved in playing him at his own game. So I'm going to play him at a game which I can do better than him. You're right. I'm formulating... You're shaping my thoughts as you speak, David, and I'm now shaping them aloud. And you're right, that was very, very mature and impressive from him. And by contrast, Kyrgios, I mean, he doesn't have a coach to discuss any kind of game plan with, but he doesn't really do game plans, does he? He just does, I'm going to go out there and do my thing, and it's going to be good enough.
Plus,
most of the time, if I'm physically fit.
Most of the time, I think Kyrgios is actually a very good tactician, just naturally. He reads the game incredibly well. Look at how well he's done against Djokovic, who's one of the ultimate match players, and he's 2-0 against him. But I think the other thing about Dimitrov. I mean, first of all, I think that the win over Del Potro, although Del Potro wasn't feeling that well, I think that that was a seminal moment for his week, in that that made him feel like he'd really achieved something. And it was kind of all downhill thereafter. He could freewheel a bit more. But Danny Valverde is...
Oh, hang on. It wasn't downhill against John Isner in the semi-final.
No, but he played such a...
Second set tie break.
It was an incredible tie break, but he still felt secure all the way through that match. Okay, he might have lost it. He wasn't going to do anything more than have to play tie breaks and win them. But he never lost his way at any point in that match. And mentally, I think he was really strong throughout those last three matches. I didn't see all of the Del Potro one, but I felt that was just a major moment for him.
Yeah, he was fantastic against Del Potro, actually. Really, really good.
The other thing is...
And Del Potro had a good week last week. You know, victory over Burdick was very impressive in that. That was a great win for Dimitrov.
Looking ahead to the US Open, you mentioned what does this mean, if anything? Does this improve...
Yeah, he's going to be seventh seed going in there.
Now,
seventh seed.
I think... It's a massive deal for him going into the US Open. And here's why. If you think of the two other biggest results that Grigor Dimitrov has ever had at Slams, semi-final of Wimbledon came a week after winning Queens.
Mm.
Australian Open semi-final, nearly beat Nadal, came after winning Brisbane. Or was it Sydney?
Yep.
I can't remember. Brisbane. Yeah, Brisbane.
Brisbane. He won Brisbane, yeah.
And that, to me... Is
yeah, it's a very good
for
point.
Not for every other player. I don't think it necessarily applies like that. Certain players, it frankly doesn't really matter what they do before, and they come out and play amazingly. Djokovic has proved that. So many of the great players have proved that. I think Dimitrov's doesn't have their innate confidence built over years of winning Grand Slams to fall back on. He has to have something tangible that can make him feel at that level, and those results made him feel like a contender. At Queens this year...
Is he a contender for you?
Yeah, he is.
A bona fide?
He really is. And, yeah. And I mean, look, if all the others were there at the top of their games, if Stan Wawrinka and Djokovic were there fully fit at the top of the game, even Kei Nishikori was there at the top of his game, he's out. Andy Murray, big question marks over. Even Roger Federer, question marks over. Nadal, who we'll talk about in a little while because he's back to world number one, question marks over because his timing looked all off to me. Dimitrov is in the pack now because he's playing as well as everybody else, really. The big question mark is whether he can win on the big occasion, but I would say that Australian Open semi-final would tell me that he can, or that he can reach a final, because he was wafer thin apart from doing so.
And how about the beaten finalist then, David? Nick Kyrgios, how much of a contender is he? Now, I commentated Nick Kyrgios' first round match in Cincinnati this week for ATP Tennis Radio against David Goffin. And to say that he was struggling physically would be an immense understatement. I mean, myself and my co-commentators were gobsmacked that he finished the match, let alone won it. I mean, it was uncomfortable to watch because he was in so much pain. He was clutching at his hip every time he was... pulled wide, every time he was landing on that left hip after serving, every time he was dragged wide on the backhand, he was in grimacing, horrible pain. And I don't think for a moment any of it was an act. That's not remotely what I'm saying. I've got no explanation. I've got nothing further to say about it other than it's yet another thing to add to the list of things that I marvel at with Nick Kyrgios and can't quite explain, because I've never seen such a physical turnaround between matches. You know, by the next match when he beat Dolgopolov, he was completely okay. I mean, absolutely, he might have been suffering in silence, but he doesn't tend to really do anything. He does show us how he's feeling on his face, whether it's with, you know, the shake of the head or whatever it is. We do tend to know how he's feeling, and there was not a hint of it for the rest of the week. So that's something. I feel in fear that he could just wake up one day, maybe in the first round, maybe in the second round, and the hip will just be killing him, and you know, who knows what that means. The match against Nadal in the quarterfinals was extraordinary. I mean, with the caveat that Cincinnati does not suit Nadal. Well, I must correct my error from last week when I was thinking off the top of my head about players that did the Canada-Cincinnati double and then went on to win the US Open. Glaring error that I missed off Nadal from that list, who did it in 2013. I was thinking sort of more historically than that. And seeing him in Cincinnati this week highlights just what an extraordinary feat it was that he did that in 2013, because Cincinnati does not suit him at all. Nothing about the conditions in Cincinnati suit him. It's too quick. The ball doesn't take his spins particularly well. It just doesn't work for him. So that has to come into it. But I mean, Kyrgios just blew him off the court. He looked shell-shocked for most of that match.
Yeah, well,
completely shell-shocked.
I think Kyrgios was just massively in the mood for it, first of all. Secondly, I think Nadal was way off timing-wise. He was really short, and I didn't see the match he played earlier that day against Albert Ramos-Vinolas. And incidentally, that's another factor. He played two matches in a day.
So did Kyrgios, though.
So he did, but I don't think it wouldn't fit Nadal.
A lot of people were making the comment on Twitter that it wouldn't be physically challenging for Nadal to play two matches one day. They were drawing attention to the fact that he's such a creature of habit and routine. Yeah. And playing the two matches really would mess up that whole routine stuff that he has going on.
Yeah.
And that was a really interesting point, I thought.
I think I could believe that. In terms of Kyrgios, look, he made a total fool of me following last week's podcast, in which I said he should probably think about not playing again the rest of this year. What it does prove to me is that I often feel that he's similar to Andy Murray. He's a more extreme version in terms of how the veering from left to right and all the rest of it in terms of his attitude and approach. But there are certain similarities, and one with Murray is I don't think any of us know how to read him in terms of how he's feeling physically. We still get it wrong in the media all these years after following him and talking to him.
That's magic. The cat meowing at me in the background. If anybody thinks I'm
awesome.
Sort of crying out in anguish at what you're saying,
tennis
David. I'm
podcast
not. It's
pet
the cat
live here on the tennis podcast.
Sorry, David,
my magic. But Nick Kyrgios, I can't read him from 1 minute to the next because of all those reasons you said about the Goffin match. I'm led to believe that it's the sort of injury that actually he could manage rather than take long periods of time out, and that he just does need to carry on playing. In terms of his approach, I think, look, his interest levels do kind of veer in and out a little bit in terms of the match and the moment.
Yeah, I mean, he gave a fantastic press conference after semi-final victory yesterday over David Ferrer, asked about that and, you know, the fact he can't do it week in, week out, and he spoke so well, and he said, look, tennis is never going to be the most important thing in my life. He talked about losing both his, or sort of obliquely implied about losing both his grandparents this year, and sort of the emotions he had about knowing that the career he's chosen meant he couldn't spend the time with them that he would have wanted to in their final days or weeks or months or whatever. And, you know, that's obviously something that he really struggles with. And, you know, he says tennis is never going to be the absolute most important live or die thing in my life. And I think we can all respect that. He said it's more important to me to be a nice, kind person. We can all absolutely respect that. I mean, I would say the two things are not remotely mutually exclusive in response to that. But, I mean, you do hear it said, oh, that so-and-so's too nice to be a great champion. It's been said about Marin Cilic, hasn't it? Probably by us. He's very frank about that. It's frustrating because we love watching him play tennis so much. The world loves watching him play tennis so much. As much as I don't hugely want to let you off the hook, I, as much as I disagreed with you last week, David, I didn't disagree with you because I saw this coming. Not at all did I see this coming. Obviously, on any given day, I believe, and I think you believe as well, he can beat anybody on any given day. Doesn't mean he will, but I certainly didn't see this run coming at this time. I just disagreed with you because I didn't see that course of action being more effective than necessarily than any other course of action. I don't think either of us, as you say, can know the mind of Nick Kyrgios remotely well enough to sort of predict what might be most effective for him. But
in terms of how he might do at the US Open, I think New York is a place that could really love Nick Kyrgios. A lot of places in the US, I don't think really have understood him or
yeah, Cincinnati weren't no, that. They felt a bit sorry for him. Really, they really didn't take to him.
No. And I think New York could
unfair. Really, I know that he got a lot of aggro on Twitter about the tweener he hit against Nadal. That was disrespectful. I don't get that. I don't buy it.
Me either.
I think, you know, tanking matches, that's disrespectful because it's not giving your best effort. That is disrespectful to your opponent. And I think the implication of suggesting hitting tweeners at points when other players wouldn't is disrespectful. It's suggesting that that's not him giving his best effort. Well, I think that is Kyrgios's way of giving his best effort. He's just different yeah. like that. That's how he gives his best effort. And provided you're giving your best effort, it's not disrespectful to the opponent. I think that's just another misunderstanding of him. But he really got a hammering for that. And I think the Cincinnati crowd didn't particularly enjoy that. And I felt for him a bit. New York are going to love him, though.
Yeah, they've loved
him before now. And but if he can really do something, they really will love
him. If he could produce the sort of Miami and Indian Wells tennis that he produced and stay fit, then he's a contender. There's in my mind there's no question about that. I question whether he will be able to stay physically fit, best of five set all the way through. He has got some sort of issue, so no, I don't think he will win the US Open.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Can we just have a quick word about Nadal?
Hey, stop. You always do this, David.
Sorry.
You send me an agenda, we discuss it.
We've only got 8 minutes
right,
left.
You're presenting this one then. Yeah, I'm keeping an eye on the clock.
Go on then. Sorry.
Dear, oh dear. Should we talk about Nadal, David?
Why don't we do that? Sorry, everybody. I promised I won't argue this week.
New world number one. It is 23:31 UK time, so in 29 minutes. I don't know what clock the ATP Emirates rankings abide by, but in 29 minutes for us, Rafael Nadal will return to world number one 9 years after he first got there. It's unbelievable. It really is. I didn't think he'd do it. I thought he had, you know, possibly another slam or two in him, although I gave him less chance of that than you did, admittedly. I certainly didn't think he had returning to number one in him.
No.
So, wow.
Neither did I. I thought he could do it again on clay. I thought he would get to the 10th French Open title, but for him to get to this point, I mean, if you wanted to be hyper cynical about it all, you could point out, which I know Stu Fraser has from the Times, that, and not that he was being critical, just he was just stating facts, that this is the lowest number one ranking total anybody's ever had. But the bottom line is he is number one, and given where he was 2 years ago around Queens, I remember we interviewed his uncle Tony at that stage, and I looked at the record he had that year, the number of losses that make you just gasp, that you can't believe that Nadal has lost to these people. And he had gone confidence-wise. It wasn't just injury. His confidence had gone. He got the yips. He couldn't hit the forehand properly anymore. And I don't know, to come back from that crisis of confidence when you're pushing 30 and starting to probably see your own tennis mortality in front of you and realize these guys are getting younger and stronger and faster and I'm getting older. For him to still come through that, to fight his way through that, and he's not Federer with that skill that can just suddenly flick a switch and there it is, and it's he's got to work his way to that point. And he went into the dungeons of training that must be so hard and painful. When you've won it all, when you've got all the money in the bank, he must have wanted it so much and has unending respect, I think, from everybody who cares about this sport.
Yeah, I mean, I echo all of that. Absolutely. It's extraordinary. I haven't changed my feelings from last week in terms of his status at the US Open. He's a contender, but not the favourite for me. I don't know who is the favourite because there's a question mark hanging over Roger Federer in the back. We know Andy Murray is in New York. He hit on Arthur Ashe Stadium court today, the first player to hit on Arthur Ashe Stadium. We saw pictures of it. The signs are good. I think he'll play. I don't know how well he'll play. But hey, last year he went into the US Open as pretty much the runaway favourite. I remember feeling as confident about Murray ahead of a Grand Slam as I ever have before last year's US Open. And he lost in that weird and thrilling quarterfinal to Kei Nishikori. So who knows?
Yeah.
Who frankly knows?
Well, that match he played against Dimitrov, I think in the fourth round, was one of the best performances of his career for me. He was just devastating. It was kind of uncomfortable to watch how much better he was than poor old Grigor. But
it was.
You're right. I mean, it was a weird quarterfinal. I mean, I heard a few days ago that he was going to travel and before it came out, but that it still felt as though it was up in the air, really, as to whether he would play. And I mean, look, he's still got a week yet, really, hasn't he, to find out whether he has any adverse reactions. We've not spoken to him, heard from him since Wimbledon. So, but the fact that he's travelled is a good sign in terms of him taking part.
Yeah, I mean, you can't play the US Open unless you're in New York.
No.
So it's a good thing.
True.
On other US Open related topics, we've had some sad news this week, some interesting news also. I'll deal with the sad first to get it out of the way and won't delve into the deep details of it because it sounds like a bit of a legal quagmire, but it sounds unlikely to me after the statement that Victoria Azarenka released this week that the two-time former finalist Azarenka will be at the US Open this year due to a custody dispute with her, the father of her child. She's unable to take the child out of California, which I think is where he and they were resident, and she's unprepared to go to the US Open without her son, Leo. So, I mean, the whole situation sounds desperately sad and awful, and I don't know what more to say about it, really. It obviously is so much bigger than tennis, but also, yeah, I mean, it just sounds dreadful. And the fact that we will miss her desperately at the US Open, it is obviously insignificant, but this is a tennis podcast, and from a tennis perspective, we really will miss her.
Yeah.
The interesting news, I'm sure it's sad for some, it's brilliant for others. Everybody knows where they sit on the spectrum. Maria Sharapova has received a US Open wild card. It's interesting how many former players have come out in support of that decision. Billie Jean King is ferociously supportive of that decision. Chris Evert, probably of all the former players, the least supportive, although she still doesn't categorically say, I think this is a bad move. She's just the most city on the fencey of all of them. I think our feelings about the Sharapova situation have been made clear. I don't think they've changed as a result of this. I don't think it's an enormous surprise, Personally, I think it's a bit of a shame that they haven't taken a stand, but, you know, it's not a surprise, I don't think. What is a surprise to me, a very disappointing one, is that Denis Shapovalov has not received a US Open wildcard, David.
Yeah, it was, a lot of people pointed out to me, because I was questioning it, a lot of people pointed out how their wildcards are so much more predetermined than normal tournaments are, in terms of they have exchange ones with the Australian and French federations.
Yeah,
they have a number that are guaranteed to the NCAA champion and all this sort of stuff. I still think this kid lit up the US Open series in Montreal, and that should count for something.
What are wild cards for if not for giving them to someone like Denis Shapovalov? What's the point of them? Just sort of a little kickback, a little bonus for tournaments that stage a Grand Slam, you know?
Scratch your back, you scratch mine.
Yeah, the whole reciprocal wildcards thing, I think it just shines a light on that, and it's not great, I don't think. And it sort of shines a light on how weird and arbitrary the whole wildcards thing is. And that's not just at the US Open, it's everywhere. But there we go. I think it's a great shame. I think he should come through qualifying because he's good enough and he's playing well enough. But we all know that qualifying is a lottery. So I just cross my fingers that he comes through. Kei Nishikori, we've mentioned, he's out for the rest of the season. He is the latest player to announce this news.
Shame. Real shame. He's so much
shame.
Fun to watch when he's on. And,
yeah.
And I think it's a wrist problem, isn't it?
He was so good last year. Yeah, and we know how bad, you know, wrist is. It's bad, isn't it? Wrist is not something you can play through. It's not something that goes away easily. It's not something there's an easy fix for. So we wish him well. David, we have a minute left of this podcast, and I know you wanted to mention the retirement of Melanie Udin. She probably deserves more time, but you've got 30 seconds.
Yeah,
just
to say, I mean, it shows how much her career has kind of been slightly forgotten about. The fact that when she announced her retirement, I had not really been aware that she hadn't already retired. It sounds terrible. She's only 25 years of age. She's remembered from 2009, age 17, beating Maria Sharapova at the US Open, getting to the quarterfinals. New York loved her. Tennis loved her for that fortnight. She was so refreshing, so uplifting, and I think we all thought we'd got a great American star to follow for the next however long. And unfortunately, ill health and all sorts of problems beset her. And it's a great shame. But I don't know her personally, but from what everybody says, she seems like a really nice person. And I wish her all the best.
Yeah, I covered a very quickly to add to that. I covered a Fed Cup tie between the USA and the Czech Republic in Brno in the Czech Republic. And the Williams sisters weren't playing, and the team was made up of Melanie Udin, Alexa Glatch, where is she now? And Bethany Matek-Sands, or Bethany Matek, as she was then, very unknown at the time. And Melanie Udin and Alexa Glatch were these huge talents, completely different. Melanie Udin, like a tiny little Dominika Sibulkova type. Alexa Glatch, this tall Maria Sharapova type. And for very different reasons, they've gone very different paths. But one is now retired and one is completely in the wilderness. It's very, very odd to see. But anyway, I'm glad we had the opportunity to mention it. David, that is the end of the 39th tennis podcast. The 340th, ladies and gentlemen, will be recorded in New York City. I'm going to need to get all the sleep I possibly can before then, because the hours in New York are as punishing as at any Grand Slam. I cannot wait, but the only thing I can wait for is the total sleep deprivation I'm going to endure. So I'm going to wrap up the podcast and say thank you very much for our 339th episode, for us not fighting this time, for you putting up with the cat whining in the background, which he is doing again. And I will see you in New York City.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.